On the Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Billy Jensen.
I'm Paul Holes.
This is the Murder Squad. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Jensen and Holes Winter Distractions. We are continuing to speak with some of our favorite people in the true crime world, and this week we're talking to somebody in the investigative journalism world.
Jerry Mitchell is an investigative journalist who worked at the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. His work there allowed him to look into civil rights cases, including the 1964 bombing of the church in Birmingham. Jerry's work resulted in several arrests throughout the years. Sam Bowers, Edgar Ray Killen, to name a couple. We're going to talk a little about that case today, but we're also going to focus on a different case he covered, one where a man was linked to two disappearances and a death. The mother of one of the missing reached out to Jerry, and he took it from there.
You know, one of the great things about the Winter Distractions is that we get to talk to people who have helped cases and, you know, cases that are already, you know, adjudicated or, you know, have really made a difference. And the 1964 bombing of the church in Birmingham is one of the most infamous crimes in American history. Four schoolgirls were murdered. It went unsolved, or at least people weren't arrested for years. Before we get into this case that you brought us right now, how were you able to go about cracking this one and actually getting people behind bars, which was really pretty amazing?
Well, I mean, the FBI deserves a tremendous amount of credit in that case. They investigated the original case, and of course, the Klan was involved in that. But I was very fortunate. I was able to sit down and talk for 6 hours with one of the last living suspects. Weirdly enough, his wife is the one that reached out to me. I think she had read something I'd written online. I did a piece called The Preacher and the Klansman. So I don't know if he thought for some reason I was going to be this sympathetic guy that was going to be like, oh, yes, you obviously had nothing to do with it. But I sat down with him. His name is Bobby Cherry. I met him and his wife in a little town near Tyler, Texas, which is not far from where I grew up, which is the schizophrenic town of Texarkana. So I knew where he lives. I drove over from Mississippi, met him and his wife, took him out for barbecue because I guess that's what you take Klansmen out for. I'm not really sure. But anyway, we ate barbecue. We talked. He's like, I didn't have anything to do with that church bombing. I left that sign shop at a 9:45 because I had to get home and watch wrestling. The sign shop he's talking about, by the way, is literally two blocks from the church. Like,
right.
It's also where the Klan made the bomb. and I didn't know all this at that moment in time. But anyway, so he tells me, it's like, I had to get home to watch wrestling. And he's talking about televised wrestling on TV in Birmingham. And he pulled out the sworn statement for this woman. Yes, I remember that night. We're all sitting around watching wrestling. So one of the rules in journalism, and this is the way we say it in the South, is even if your mama tells you she loves you, check it out. Mm-hmm. So I checked it out. I talked to our librarian, Susan Garcia, and said, Susan, just check with the Birmingham News and see what was on TV that night. Because I remember from when I was a little kid, they used to run the entire television schedule in a pretty small box in the newspaper. And so she checked with the Birmingham News, and next day Susan tells me there was no wrestling. So I'm like, what?
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah. So then you were able to go from there to pinning it on. Did he name names after that?
Yeah, he got arrested after that. Yeah, his alibi went up in smoke. So, yeah.
Well, that was one of the amazing things about, you know, you're talking about 1964. There were only, you know, seven, maybe eight TV stations. If you add UHF in,
yeah,
you couldn't say you were watching Lord of the Rings on streaming or whatever. It's just that's it. You know,
there were only two stations in Birmingham.
That's it. Yeah. Amazing. So, and that's the thing. It's just like, you know, you sort of crack that. And then like the archivist who's going through probably, was it even on microfiche or did they have it, you know, on, did they have to actually go through the actual physical paper?
Yeah, they had to pull it. Yeah, they pulled it on microfilm. Yeah. The librarian at the Birmingham News as a favor to our library and pulled it from microfilm. Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing.
And then it was back when you had faxes too. So it came out in these really long faxes up on the fax machine.
So who was eventually arrested for the crime?
Yeah, Bobby Sherry was arrested in that case. And so was a guy named Tommy Blanton. And they were both went on to be convicted in that case. I also found out in the Cherry case is that I heard he had something to do with the beating of Fred Shuttlesworth. Mm-hmm. And he was a famous civil rights activist. He's actually the one who invited Dr. King to Birmingham. I know we've all seen the footage of the dogs, yeah, the fire hoses, the kids marching and all that. Well, Fred Shuttlesworth's the one who invited Dr. King to come to Birmingham. And that was a part of that campaign where King, of course, we have a letter from the Birmingham jail, all these things that we kind of know about. Fred Shuttlesworth's the one who invited him.
Oh, wow.
And so Fred Shuttlesworth was beaten, I don't know how many times, plus his church was blown up, plus his house was blown up on Christmas Day. And I mean, they tried to kill Fred Shuttlesworth many times over, and he somehow survived. So one of the perks of my job, just once I started diving into these cases, first the Meg Rivers case and then Vernon Dahmer case and the Mississippi Burning case. So publishers started sending me books, mm-hmm, on the civil rights movement. And so in the mail one day, I got a big thick biography of Fred Shuttlesworth. And the first thing, I picked it up and the first thing I do, I don't know if you're like me, but when I get a big thick book, look at the pictures. Mm-hmm. So I'm flipping through the pictures. And there's a picture of the beating of Fred Shuttlesworth. I heard Bobby Cherry had something to do with it.
Yeah.
But he kind of denied it when I asked him about it. So I called the author. There was a picture of it, but it was a real distant shot. Really couldn't make anybody out. So I called the author and said, hey, there you go, the pictures of the beating of Fred Shuttlesworth. He's like, oh, there's footage of it. I'm like, you're kidding. There's footage. Wow. Part of this old CBS documentary, which I was able to get a hold of. It wasn't like it was on YouTube or something like that back then. It was, it was on, I got it in a VHS tape, fortunately able to get it for less than $200 for what they were trying to charge me for it. Mm-hmm. But I played it. And my problem was I had no idea what, Bobby Sherry looked like in 1957, yeah, which is when this happened. And so I called his son, who was a truck driver, kind of semi-estranged from his dad, said, hey, Tom, would you mind coming by and look at this footage? He goes, yeah, sure. So he comes by. I played the footage for him. He goes, there's dad right there.
Oh, jeez.
Wow.
And even pointed out something I didn't see. He said, yeah, you see him reaching his right front pocket? That's where he kept his brass knuckles. Oh. Sure enough, you can see him hit Fred Shuttlesworth and he goes, why?
So this started with a woman contacting you because you had written something.
Yeah. I had interviewed him. I had actually talked to him once before on telephone. So she reached out to me.
And then you got him for like one of the biggest crimes in the history of America.
I got him for a 6-hour interview. And then when I called him back, I called him back once his alibi blew up and he was like, he stuck to it. And he doubled down on it. It was like, there was no damn films of the 50s. Wrestling was on.
All right. Well, anyway, excellent work with that. And if anybody, Letter from Birmingham Jail is one of the most incredible pieces of American literature by Dr. King. Everybody, if you haven't read it, read it. It's pretty short, but it's amazing. But you had a case that is pretty incredible, and it's very much a case that is something that falls very in line with true crime these days. It's the case of a guy named Felix Vail.
Yeah.
Tell us about Felix Vail, because this guy was pretty horrific and was leaving a lot of bodies in his wake, and people were connecting the dots, but nobody could pin it on him.
I know, it was awful. Well, I had this, I happened to have been on the radio. I was on a guest on Democracy Now! And this lady in Massachusetts heard it and called me and said, a serial killer living in Mississippi or writing about him. I'm like, well, yeah, sure. And so long story short, she started telling me this story, this guy named Felix Vail, was married in 1962 or 61 to this woman named Mary Horton. And then she drowned accidentally. He married in 61.
They married in July of 61. The following year, gave birth to a son named William or Bill.
Bill.
In October. Yeah. And in September of 62, though, it's apparently she had told her mom that she was maybe thinking of leaving Felix at one point, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. She told her mom she was thinking about leaving Felix. And then in October, Felix took her out supposedly trout line fishing. And she supposedly fell out of the boat.
Now, what is trout line fishing for everybody that doesn't know?
Well, that's right. For people who are not so familiar with it, it's where you lay down a line and you essentially you have like a hook every, I don't know, 5 feet or whatever it is. You have a hook with bait, essentially. And weirdly enough, to catch catfish, which a lot of these people do, I went out with a guy. And he used ivory soap, which I thought was kind of fascinating. I had no idea you could fish with ivory soap. But anyway, they bait the hooks and then you come back however many hours later and then you pull the fish, literally just pull the fish from the hook. So that's kind of how trout line fishing works. So he claimed he went out at night to go trout line fishing and that his wife fell out of the boat. And he dove in and tried to save her. And
the investigation showed that prior to Mary's death, Felix had purchased life insurance.
Two life insurance policies.
There's a tell right there. Okay.
Yeah. So we have two tells right there. He tells the police or whoever was willing. I mean, did the police even go out there and say she fell? There was a swirl.
He shows up at the shoreline. Uh-huh. Here's the other part. It's just, it makes no sense at all. So here he is. He's supposedly trying to rescue his wife and then gets back in his boat, goes 6 miles downstream and pulls his boat into the dock there. Like there's plenty of people along the way. He could have like stopped or got help or,
yeah,
you know, this is the days before cell phones, but people would have phones in their house. So you could walk in and go, hey, my wife fell in the water. I need help. You know, now he went 6 miles downriver and shows up there and says, oh, my wife fell out. And I, you know, tried to save her. And there's so many it was obvious even to the deputies at the time that he had killed his own wife.
Right. So the body was recovered 2 days later.
Correct.
But a grand jury decided not to indict, you know, because he was arrested the next year. What was going on with that grand jury? Why did the grand jury not indict him?
I think it had something to do with the district attorney. The district attorney's father was friends with Felix's family.
Oh,
geez.
Okay. So, okay. Yeah, because I'm looking at the photo of Mary being pulled out of the water, you know.
What do you think?
Well, you know, here you've got, you know, the... her husband saying she fell out of the boat, and now you see the scarf tied around her neck. You know, I believe it was stuffed, 4 to 6 inches into her mouth. You know, it obviously he's lying because that doesn't happen just underwater. You know,
yeah, it doesn't. The scarf doesn't magically go in the mouth.
No. You know, and then I guess she had some deposits on the side of her head, mud deposits, or something else that was not from the river, as well as a very large contusion or bruise behind it on the back of her head, which, you know, that would be, I mean, you see a body, if it's hitting a rock or something in the currents, that's part of the difficulty in determining drownings, accident versus suicide, is you do have similar injuries sometimes. The scar stands out. I'm looking at this photo going, you know, if she had just been a missing person and her body washed up, you'd go, well, this is a homicide. Here you have her husband saying she just fell over the side of the boat. He's lying.
And he's told several different versions about what supposedly happened. It wasn't like he stayed consistent about his details at all. He'll claim at the time that he there was a stump that she pointed out, and she was sitting on the back of the seat. I mean, a lot of the details are just like highly suspicious.
And I have a feeling that he was not planning on her body being discovered, because, you know, his statement is so off that he's probably just thinking. And then he's taking a boat 6 miles downstream. That's misdirection right there. He's trying to get as far away from where her body is at, not understanding how bodies respond in water and float up and everything else.
So the jury didn't, the grand jury didn't indict. I don't know that they had much of a chance. You know, DA's, district attorneys pretty much have a lot of power with regard to what grand juries do or don't do, as you probably know. And so I don't know that the grand jury had much of a chance to vote on this, other than, you know, that the DA may have said, hey, let's just punt this, let's take this up later or something like that. I don't know all that. I could never.
We're also talking about 1960s Louisiana, too, with
1962 Louisiana. And this was a very corrupt parish. I mean, the sheriff was basically implicated for taking bribes. And I had an attorney tell me this whole story about how the sheriff would never go into the office. He would only pull up in his car. it's just incredible. All the incredible corruption. Anyway,
I remember taking my first ever and last ever law class in high school. So many things would say this law is applicable in all 49 states except Louisiana.
Except for Louisiana.
So Louisiana is a completely different place. So after the grand jury decides not to indict, Felix gets out of there. He takes his son. They become a bit of a nomad, goes to Mississippi, then goes to California, and then he meets Sharon Hensley in 1973. And they meet in San Francisco. Actually, they meet in San Francisco in 69. His son is 8 years old. And what was Sharon like? What was her deal?
Sharon came from North Dakota. She was a model, done some modeling, but just a beauty, you know. And she came to California like so many, you know, students and young people did during that era, you know, the flower power, Haight-Ashbury, all those days, you know. And so she joined some of her friends and, you know, from that area, Bismarck of North Dakota, and just went to California. So that's how she met Felix.
Right. So apparently, and this is where the 8-year-old son, Billy, comes in. And apparently 8-year-old son, Bill, said he heard his father tell Sharon that he'd kill his mom previously.
Walked 2 miles to the police department. He told a friend, you know, my dad keeps giving me drugs. I don't like drugs. And the friend pointed him, an older friend pointed him to the sheriff, you know, the police department. And so he walked 2 miles. And that's what he told him as soon as he said, my dad keeps giving me drugs. I don't want drugs. Oh, no, by the way, overheard my dad say he killed my mom.
And this was LSD his dad was giving him. 69, San Francisco.
Yeah, LSD. This is not just any drug.
So what Felix does is Felix decides this son, who's 8 years old and obviously incredibly brave, decides he's kind of a loose cannon and could be a threat to him. He sends him to Mississippi, but then they go back to Mississippi. Him and Sharon show up there when he's 13, and he tells the son, I don't blame you for what happened in California. He says he blames Sharon. And then what happens?
Then Sharon disappears.
Jesus.
I mean, that's really what, you know, they kind of went around for a while, but Sharon disappeared. She never came back.
What was his story about Sharon now?
That they went to Florida, went to the Keys in Key West, and they're down in Key West, and Felix's story was he claimed that there was an Australian couple they met in Key West, and they were traveling around the world, and they were going to stop at all these various places, and he named them all. And that Sharon got on the boat with them, and, you know, she wanted to disappear and all that kind of stuff. And of course, never seen again.
Does Bill remember, you know, after his dad went out with Sharon, how long his dad was out before he came back?
Yeah, it was in, I think that time frame's about right. 72, 73 is about, I think, when he saw.
When that was happening.
And then Sharon disappeared in early 73. It would have been, to my knowledge, it would have been, there are pictures of her in Mississippi.
Okay.
And this would have been around Christmas time, I believe.
Yeah.
I presume that's when it was.
This wasn't like overnight. His dad went out and then shared. This was over the course of weeks, if not months. Okay. Yes. Got it.
Yeah, it was.
You know, because it strikes me just, you know, here Felix is with Sharon alone in San Francisco. And then he comes back to Mississippi, which is an anchor point for him. And then that's now when Sharon disappears. He's coming back into his comfort zone. And he's also been arrested, indicted for the disappearance of his, and homicide of his first wife, where he was in the same location at the same time, his wife, you know, so he's learning from past mistakes.
He got arrested, but he was never indicted in that case.
Oh, he wasn't. That's right. Correct. So I'm looking at this and I'm saying, OK, so here he is. He's coming back to his comfort zone. In all likelihood, my guess is that Sharon was killed and left in Mississippi and he ends up.
She was in Florida.
And then came back.
No, she didn't. No, she never came back.
Do you think she's over the boat out in Key West?
I think she's in the Keys. Yeah, out in the ocean. He wrote a letter to his mother that we were able to get, you know, after Felix got arrested. And basically what it said was he wrote a letter to his mother and said that I'm divorced now, you know, He's talking about with her, him and Sharon. I'm divorced now. And he talked about Sharon had a boyfriend and he sent them off into the ocean together. And suddenly he's going around in a boat and he didn't have a boat before this.
Oh, interesting.
Like he didn't have anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Mississippi stop was just a routine stop, possibly to set up what he was going to be doing when he was out in Florida.
Every 11 years, this is what he's doing. He meets a woman named Annette Carver in Houston when she's 15.
Yeah.
And this is in 81. So he's 42. She's 15. 2 years later, they get married when she's 17. And like he's wont to do, he lives off of her inheritance that she got from her dad who had died. Right.
Yeah.
Now, the two began having problems, and Annette goes to stay with her mom, Mary Rose, in Oklahoma.
Right.
And then what happens then?
Felix at some point shows up. Like, she goes and lives there. You know, she's with her mom, and then Felix, who'd been dating her, you know, the mom didn't know about this, but Felix had been dating her, and then he suddenly shows up on a motorcycle and says, I'm going to Mexico, and goes with Annette. And Ness wants to go with him.
He sort of came to help because they were fighting. The mom and the daughter were fighting. And apparently, and didn't the mother's house was put into Annette's name and then it was eventually put into.
Yeah, that was later on.
That was later on. Okay.
Yeah. This is a sequence of time now. So she goes off with Felix. They go to Mexico. They get married. And then they come back. She and Felix have had a fight. They're already married at this point. And so she splits from Felix from a little bit, comes to her mom. In fact, tells her mom the story of Felix swung to hit her at one point and broke his hand, like missed her and hit the wall. But she had made up some story, or he had, and went along with it. About a pot broke on his hand or something like that. But anyway, so then Felix comes back into the equation and now mom gets forced out. And then you're right, you know, eventually Annette has her, you know, sign the house completely over to her. And then Annette signs the house over to entirely to Felix. There are actually two properties involved with this. So it's actually two homes.
And what happens then?
And then Annette disappears.
So we have another woman disappearing now, another significant other, third one, all 11 years apart. What does Felix say? What's his excuse?
Felix's story this time, you know, is that, you know, he and Annette went to St. Louis. They were going through the St. Louis Zoo. Annette met these guys from Mexico who invited her to go down to Mexico. and she wanted to do that. And so he put her on the bus with these Mexican guys heading down to Mexico. He hadn't seen her since.
All right. So, and what did her mother do? Was her mother, did her mother confront her? Yeah.
Well, her mother didn't know any of this. Like, her mom, she heard from a neighbor that when Felix came back, Annette wasn't with her. Felix didn't tell her anything. And so she eventually began to call Felix and then showed up in Tulsa. This is Tulsa, Oklahoma. And Felix, it's like, oh yeah, she just left. And then the police believe Felix, which is unfortunate.
So then you've got Mary Rose, the mom.
Correct.
And eventually she reaches out to seemingly the only other person that was suspecting him or at least, taking action with him, which is his son, Bill.
Yeah.
And what was that relationship? How did they get together? And what was Bill doing for the case? And then how does...
She began to, because the police wouldn't do anything, essentially Mary Rose kind of became a detective herself and kind of began to start piecing things together as much as she could. For instance, she found out, she found out about Sharon Hensley. She found out about the first wife. Then she found out about Sharon Hensley because, she was found out about the first wife drowning from Felix's sister. And then also found out when the sister also said, oh, and of course, there's that Sharon, disappeared. And of course, none of this, she didn't know any of this. Mary Rose did. And so she began to kind of piece some of these things together. And actually met with the FBI. They were supposedly they had a serial killer unit. They were going to try to get into this. And then the guy that was kind of heading that left, and it just all kind of fell apart. And so that's, nothing happened. But she did contact Bill and begin to have communication with Bill. And so he was told all these stories we're talking about now. He's unfortunately passed away now, but he recorded all this actually.
With Mary or with the dad? Had he been in touch with the dad?
Bill never taped any of his conversations with his father that I'm aware of.
Okay.
But what he did do was before he died, Bill recorded about a 45 or so minute interview. Someone interviewed him and he kind of recorded all this and told his whole life story.
Wow. So he passes away. Mary Rose does not want to stop the investigation. Yeah. What were your first steps? Like, you hear this story. Had you ever heard this story before? Had you heard anything about it before?
No, I never heard anything about the case before. It was all news to me. And it was very odd to me because you had these three cases and supposedly and what, he never got arrested. And I found it very odd that he had somehow walked away from all this. And I know she said that, the FBI was supposedly looking at him. I was like, well, why didn't anybody do anything, And so she said the magic words. We had email conversations and phone conversations. And then she said the magic words. I want to go confront him. I was like, oh, I want to be there. reporter, these are like, words to my ears, magic words to my ears. So she's like, I want to be there. So she came to Mississippi and went to go confront Felix. I had no idea where this was. It's up in Northeast Mississippi. It's about a half hour north of Starkville, if you know where Mississippi State is. And so we went up, I met her and went with her because I didn't know where his house was or place was. It was a trailer, actually. We got to where his trailer was. The gate was locked. She hopped over the gate. Oh, so I followed her. So we go down this little trail and, the weeds are like 10 feet high, just like right in the movies, And we get to the opening. There's kind of an opening and there's a trailer. It's like a new looking Airstream trailer. And she goes and knocks on the door and he doesn't answer. And I'm like looking around, I see woods all around us. And I peeked in the trailer and I didn't see anything. I'm like, is this guy around here? What's going on? And the next thing I know, she's taken off for there's a second trailer she takes off for. And you could see there was like plywood behind the window, the front of the trailer. It looked like a pretty beaten up trailer. So she got over there before I did, and she figured out that that she could crawl in through the back window. Jeez. So she did. So she opened the front door. So now I can see in. I didn't want to trespass. You know, I don't want to trespass. So as a reporter. So she opened the front door. So now I can see. So she starts rummaging around. Next thing you know, she throws out a machete and it clanks on the floor. And then she throws out another machete and another machete and all these swords. I'm like, what have I gotten myself into?
So, yeah, there's so many. I mean, great, but there's so many things wrong going on here. You know, officer safety issues going on. We're lucky that there wasn't a Mary and Jerry missing persons report filed after this.
Oh, I know. It was crazy. It was all crazy. So,
I mean, that's the one thing that, you know, you can, I mean, you held back a little bit. The one thing that you can do in print that you don't necessarily, that TV wouldn't let you do. TV would say, nope, don't go through the gate even. So, but, yeah.
Well, I don't know if I would have, if I'd call my editors, if they would have said, go ahead. But I knew in general, there was this rule that you could go to somebody's door, right, and knock on, mm-hmm, and they can either refuse to, and if they refuse to talk to you, you've got to leave. Mm-hmm. But given that he didn't answer and we were going to another trailer, I felt like I was okay. I didn't know about her, but I was.
Oh, so she committed burglary, but you know, that's all.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. She was guilty, but I was fine.
And for TV, you would have been allowed to go up to the door. Your camera guy would have had to stay at the gate.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So you could still knock on the door. Fair enough.
There's the producer
you're
talking.
You're zooming in really, really far and not a good shot, but you can do it.
Yeah.
There you go.
Does she ever get to confront him
in the courtroom?
In the courtroom. Okay, so you write the book.
Yeah, I wrote a lot. I wrote 9,000 words, and later a lot more. Yeah, and we ran it in this huge section, right, in 8 pages.
Was it a series or was it just one big story?
No, it was one shot deal. It was a whole section.
Okay.
Of the newspaper.
All right.
8 pages.
So you write that. Does that give you any traction in terms of justice?
Yeah, he was arrested 7 months later.
Very cool. So then obviously after that, you write the book, the book's released, and you had a friend of his contacted you, a guy named Wesley Turnage, right?
Yeah, that was within the first week when my first piece ran
in the
newspaper. Literally days after, he called me and was like, he told me that Felix had told him about killing his first wife. So, you know, wow. So, yeah.
And then other people start coming forward too.
Correct.
Did they reexamine the autopsy?
Yes.
And what happened there?
Here's what happened, at least on my end of it. While I was still working on that piece, I happen to know Dr. Michael Bodden, who's a renowned pathologist. He used to have his own TV show on HBO. And because he worked on the Megan Rivers case, that's how I got to know him. So I send him the autopsy and the first wife. And they just ruled accidental drowning. You know, it's time. And he came back and said, this is a homicide. And so obviously I thought, well, okay, now this is a homicide. This isn't just, you know, so obviously if it's a homicide and somebody killed somebody, you know, so that put a whole different spin on it as well.
And what did they determine when the pathologist and the coroner reexamined the autopsy?
They determined the same thing that Dr. Bodden determined, and he actually testified at the trial. So Dr. Bodden testified, and so did the local coroner.
Yep.
And they both concluded it was a homicide.
And of note is that they determined that Mary was dead before she was in the water. You know, now, yeah. Exactly. She's not breathing in the water.
Yeah, she wasn't. It wasn't accidentally falling off the boat. She was dead before she hit the water.
And then they saw the, obviously, the scarf 3 to 4 inches inside her mouth. Also, I think they said possible signs of strangulation as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think you've got him now. And so where is he now? What happened at the trial?
He was convicted. In fact, Mary Rose was allowed to testify. It was really, it's a very odd kind of thing, but it's actually happened. There's a thing called the doctrine of chance. This gets more technical. I'm kind of getting down the weeds of the law, but it explains that there's something in federal law. It's also states, pretty much all states have adopted. It's called 404B material. Essentially, I can't just present, if I'm doing a murder case, I can't go in and go, oh, this guy's a bad guy because he shoplifted when he was a kid. He did this, he did that. You know what I mean? You can't present somebody's criminal record, essentially, you know, when you're doing a murder case or something like that. But there are exceptions to 404B. So there's something called the doctrine of chances. And basically, it goes back to a serial killer case. It stems from a serial killer case in London that was called, that involved these women who were killed, initially they didn't realize they were killed, but they died in the bathtub, like they drowned in the bathtub. So all these women, these new brides, were all drowning in the bathtub. And there was a rash of them. And it turns out it was one guy. And Chris, he kept changing his name. And then he got greedy and started like trying to do insurance fraud as well. So instead of just taking their possessions, he decided to take out life insurance policies. And that's how he got caught. Really fascinating. And so he got arrested. And that's how they did it. They were able to present evidence of these other deaths to prove it wasn't just chance.
So the doctrine of chance is basically, what are the odds that
what are the odds that a guy has three wives, you know, that disappeared?
Yeah. Well, and we hear about these types of cases. I mean, how many of these, guys have been married to women that have died, you know, falling down a flight of stairs, you know, exactly. Oh, the second one
falling off a cliff.
Right. Those kind of cases. You know, so this is something where that doctrine of chances that, you know, I have never heard that as a legal term. I'm not sure that's something that is in California, but that actually is something to make an argument for when you start looking, if you can admit past history. You know, that's the big thing from a legal challenge in many ways.
And that also brings the question to us, is it only three? Are there only three women?
Oh, in my opinion, no. I mentioned there was apparently a boyfriend that Sharon was with.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't help but think maybe the boyfriend met his demise as well, given what Felix wrote in the letter. And his son, Bill, talked about some other people as well that his dad claimed he killed a guy in Mexico on the beach. Mm-hmm. And buried his body there. I mean, so there are several other things like that.
Yeah.
There's supposedly a black kid that Felix ran over when he was young. And I've never been able to confirm that. I've tried, but anyway, so there are different things that supposedly different people that Felix has supposedly killed over the years.
So we have this map of his travels across the United States. And Billy, yep. I mean, you look at that map. Does that remind you of somebody that you've got a case that high profile case that you've been involved with?
Well, it's a bit like Rasmussen. Yeah,
exactly.
Because although Rasmussen was a little bit more north, and we're talking about the Allenstown 4 case, Bear Brook, Jerry. But this guy, so, you know, just taking a look now at Felix Vail, he hit, it looks like, every state in the South. You know, so he sort of did a swing of places that he lived, San Francisco down to Los Angeles. Right. Looks like he didn't really stop in Arizona, but he did Albuquerque, did a bunch of places in Texas, up to Tulsa. He did Memphis, Montpelier, Lake Charles, New Orleans, Miami, Key West, and also a lot in Mexico. So this is one of those places where when we talk to the murder squad, you know, take a look at this map, take a look at when he was there with these specific periods and see if you can find any murders that that he potentially could be connected to. And we'll send him over to Jerry and Jerry can get another book out of it.
Yeah, sure. You know, and I'm eyeballing San Francisco, 1968, 1970, and then 1977. And it's like, well, if he's in San Francisco, is he in Contra Costa County, my old jurisdiction? Do I have any cases out of my case files that maybe Felix could be responsible for? So that's interesting. But, you know, this map is very telling. And Rasmussen, I mean, these guys, you know, they stay in a place for a short period of time and they move, and then they move. Why are they moving so much? Well, they're basically trying to hide their trail. They're doing something and then moving away from it.
Yeah, it, you know, it was very much when we started looking at this case, I got a lot of Rasmussen feel for it. Now, he is in life in prison. He remains in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And has he ever talked about trying to make a deal or anything like that to tell them where other bodies might be?
You know, the district attorney right before trial tried to get Felix to plead guilty. I think they were trying to get maybe a manslaughter plea out of him in exchange for telling what he did with the women. Mm-hmm. And he wouldn't go for it. They're thinking, I think the district attorney is thinking, either way, it's the same. You know, it's a manslaughter and you get 20 years. You know, it's not going to be, you know, life is, you know, essentially it's not going to be less than, you know, a life sentence. So I think right. that was the reason, the rationale for that.
Right. Do you think he'll ever talk about, no. He'll never talk, right? He's one of those guys that's,
yeah. Well, he has very much what I would call, and I don't think I'm exaggerating, a messianic complex. I mean, he really kind of, he had dreams about, he levitated 10 feet above the air. Everyone was like worshiping him. Like, no, I don't think Felix is ever going to admit that he killed these women.
Wow. All right. Well, everybody, you know, this is a winter distraction, but you do have an assignment, Murder Squad.
To go take a look at Felix's trails.
You know, and this guy was in big places like New Orleans and Miami in the 70s. But also smaller places, too, that have those smaller newspapers.
Yeah.
And then also Mexico, you know, being in Mexico between 65 and 70, you know, that's definitely something where, you know, if anybody has any beads on newspapers out of there and figuring out where he exactly was. Do we know the towns that he was in Mexico?
I can get those to you. I don't.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I can get those to you. The ones that I know of.
That'd be excellent. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, Jerry, thank you so much. For
absolutely.
This was fantastic. I mean, cracking, you know, two cases like this is, you know, you're lucky as a journalist if you can crack one and you know, you had obviously a big one that you could have just sat there and rested on that, but you just kept going. And that's one of the great things about being in, you know, writing is that people come to you and say, hey, can you look at this? Can you look at that?
Yeah. Yeah. And if you don't mind me plugging my book on the last note,
of course,
Race Against Time. There you go. Race Against Time is the book I wrote about. It's about four civil rights cold cases that I worked on and there were convictions in those cases. So, yeah.
Excellent. Okay. So where can people find you?
Find me or the book?
Not find you, like not your address or anything, but like, are you on social media? Do you have a website?
I run a nonprofit called the Mississippi Center for Investigative Reporting. And we have a website called MississippiCIR.org. So people can go there and see some of our stories. In fact, we're working on a cold case now of this woman who's in prison for life. And it appears that the murder didn't happen. So it's a fascinating case, but
There's just no murder, like there's no body, there's never a murder?
No, it was ruled a homicide, and it appears that it was a suicide. The original pathologist has actually now reversed himself in the case. Mm. He originally ruled it a homicide, now has reversed himself, said it's a suicide.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for joining us. For everybody else, we've got some merch for the cold days ahead. Subscribe, follow us on social, go check out Jerry's site and go buy some of Jerry's books. And until then, keep digging.
Keep digging. Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions. Senior producer, Paulie Katowski. Associate producer, Haley Gray. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel.
Executive producers, Karen Kilgariff, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.